miniature dogs. Simon found a scrap of greasy skin on a deserted chair and tossed it to the little dog. It wagged its stub of tail as it bolted the treat, then followed at Simon's heels as he carried the ewer across the room. Fengbold and Guthwulf, the long-jawed Earl of Utanyit, were involved in some kind of wrist-wrestling contest, their daggers drawn and plunged into the tabletop on either side of the combatant's arms. Simon stepped around the table as nimbly as he could, pouring wine from the heavy ewer into the cups of the shouting spectators and trying not to trip over the dog, which was darting in and out between his feet. The king was watching the contest with amusement, but he had his own page at his shoulder, so Simon left his goblet alone. He poured Prairati's wine last, avoiding the priest's glance, but could not help noticing the strange scent of the man, an inexplicable amalgam of metal and oversweet spices. Backing away, he saw the little dog rooting in the straw near Prairati's shiny black boots, on the track of some fallen treasure. "Come!" Simon hissed, backing farther away and slapping his knee, but the dog paid no heed. It began to dig with both paws, its back bumping against the priest's red-robed calf. "Come along," Simon whispered again. Prairates turned his head to look down, shiny skull pivoting slowly on his long neck. He lifted his foot and brought his heavy boot down on the dog's back, a swift, compact movement finished in a heartbeat. There was a crack of splintered bone and a muffled squeal. The little dog writhed helplessly in the straw, until Prairates lifted his heel again and crushed its skull. The priest stared for a disinterested moment at the body, then lifted his gaze, his eyes alighting on Simon's horrified face. That black stare, remorseless, unconcerned, caught and held him. Prairates' flat, dead eyes flicked down again to the dog. And when they returned to Simon, a slow grin stretched across the priest's face. "What can you do about it, boy?" the smile said. "And who cares?" The priest's attention was drawn back to the table. Simon, freed, dropped the ewer and stumbled away, looking for a place to throw up. It was just before midnight. Fully half the revelers had staggered or been carried off to bed. It was doubtful many of them would be present for the morrow's coronation. Simon was pouring into a drunken guest's cup the heavily watered wine that was all Peter Gildedbowl would serve at this late hour, when Earl Fengbold, the only one remaining of the king's party, staggered into the hall from the commons outside. The young noble was dishevelled and his breeches were half undone, but he wore a beatific smile on his face. "Come outside, everybody," he shouted. "Come outside now. Come see." He lurched back out the door. Those who could do it pulled themselves to their feet and followed him, elbowing and jesting, some singing drunkenly. Fengbold stood in the commons, head tilted backward, black hair hanging unbound down the back of his stained tunic, as he stared up into the sky. He was pointing. One by one, the faces of the followers turned up to look. Across the sky, a strange shape was painted, like a deep wound that spurted blood against the night black. A great red comet, streaming across the sky from north to south. "A bearded star," someone shouted. "An omen." "The old king is dead, dead, dead," cried Fengbold, waving his dagger in the air as if daring the stars to come down and fight. "Long live the new king," he shouted. "A new age is begun." Cheers rang out, and some of those present stamped their feet and howled. Others began a giddy, laughing dance, men and women holding hands as they whirled in a circle. Above them, the red star gleamed like a smouldering coal. Simon, who had followed the merrymakers outside to see the cause of the ruckus, turned back to the hall. The shouts of the dancers floated up behind him. He was surprised to see Dr. Morgani standing in the shadows of the bailey wall. The old man, wrapped in a heavy robe against the chill air, did not notice his apprentice. He too was staring up at the bearded star, the scarlet slash across the vault of heaven. but unlike the others, there was no drunkenness or glee upon his face. He looked fearful and cold and small. He looked, Simon thought, like a man alone in the wilderness, listening to the hungry song of wolves. Chapter 7. The Conqueror Star. The spring and summer of Elias' first regnal year were magical, sun-bright with pomp and display. All Austin Ard seemed reborn. The young nobility came back to fill the Hayholt's long, quiet halls, and so marked was the difference that they might have brought colour and daylight with them to what had been a dark place. As in John's young days, the castle was full of laughter and drinking, and the swagger of shining battle blades and armour. At night, music was heard in the hedged gardens once more, and the splendid ladies of the court flitted to or fled from assignations in the warm darkness like graceful, flowing ghosts. The tawny field sprang back to life, sprouting multicoloured tents like a bank of flowers. To the common people it seemed as though every day was holiday, and that the merrymaking would have no end. King Elias and his friends made furious sport, in the manner of children who must soon be put to bed and know it. All of Erkinland seemed to roister and tumble, like a summer drunken dog. Some of the villagers muttered darkly. It was hard to get the spring crop sowed with such heedlessness in the air. Many of the older, sourer priests grumbled at the spread of licentiousness and gluttony. But most people laughed at these doomsayers. Elias' monarchy was but newly coined, and Erkinland, all of Austin Ard, it seemed, had come out of a long winter of age into a season of headlong youth. How could that be unnatural? Simon felt his fingers cramping as he laboriously traced the letters onto the grey parchment. Morghenes was at the window, holding a long fluted piece of glass pipe up to the sunlight as he examined it for dirt. "If he says one word about the thing not being properly cleaned, I'll walk out," Simon thought. "The only sunshine I see anymore is what's reflected in the beakers I polish." Morghenes turned from the window and brought the piece of glass pipe over to the table where Simon slaved at his writing. As the old man approached, Simon prepared himself for the scolding, feeling a swelling of resentment that seemed to lodge between his shoulder blades.
"A lovely job, Simon," Morghenes said as he laid the pipette down beside the parchment. "You take much better care of things around here than I ever could by myself."
The doctor gave him a pat on the arm and leaned over.
"How are you coming there?"
"Terribly," Simon heard himself say. Even though the resentful knot was still there, he was disgusted by the petty tone of his own voice. "I mean, I'll never be good at this. I can't make the letters cleanly without the ink blobbing up, and I can't read any of what I'm writing anyway." He felt a little better for having said it, but he still felt stupid.
"You're worrying about nothing, Simon," the doctor said, and straightened up.
He seemed distracted. As he spoke, his eyes darted about the room.
"First of all, everybody's writing blobs up. At first, some folks spend their whole lives blobbing up. That doesn't mean they have nothing important to say. Secondly, of course you can't read the things you're writing. The book is written in Nabene. You can't read Nabene."
"But why should I copy words that I don't understand?" Simon growled.
"That's foolish."
Morghenes turned sharp eyes back to Simon.
"Since I told you to do it, I suppose I'm foolish too?"
"No, I didn't mean that. It's just that..."
"Don't bother to explain."
The doctor pulled up a stool and sat by Simon's side. His long bent fingers scrabbled aimlessly in the rubbish of the tabletop.
"I want you to copy these words because it's easier to concentrate on the form and shape of your letters if you're not distracted by the subject matter."
Simon felt only partially satisfied. "Can't you tell me what book it is anyway? I keep looking at the pictures, but I still can't figure it out." He flipped the page back to an illustration that he had stared at many times in the past 3 days, a grotesque woodcut of an antlered man with huge staring eyes and black hands. Cringing figures huddled at his feet. Above the horned man's head, a flaming sun hung against an ink-black sky. "Like this," Simon pointed at the strange picture. "Here at the bottom it says, Sa Astridan Condiciles. What does that mean?"
"It means," Morgana said as he closed the cover and picked the book up, "the Conqueror's Star. And it is not the kind of thing that you need to know about."
He placed the book on a precariously balanced stack against the wall. "But I'm your apprentice," Simon protested. "When are you going to teach me something?"
"Idiot boy, what do you think I'm doing? I'm trying to teach you to read and to write. That's the most important thing. What do you want to learn?"
"Magic," Simon said immediately. Morganis stared at him.
"And what about reading?"
the doctor asked ominously. Simon was cross. As usual, people seemed determined to balk him at every turn. "I don't know," he said. "What's so important about reading and letters anyway? Books are just stories about things. Why should I want to read books?" Morganis grinned, an old stoat finding a hole in the henyard fence.
"Ah, boy, how can I be mad at you? What a wonderful, charming, perfectly stupid thing to say."
The doctor chuckled appreciatively, deep in his throat. "What do you mean?" Simon's eyebrows moved together as he frowned. "Why is it wonderful and stupid?"
"Wonderful because I have such a wonderful answer,"
Morganis laughed.
"Stupid because? Because young people are made stupid, I suppose. As tortoises are made with shells and wasps with stings. It is their protection against life's unkindnesses."
"Begging your pardon," Simon was totally flummoxed now. "Books," Morganis said grandly, leaning back on his precarious stool.
"Books are magic. That is the simple answer. And books are traps as well."
"Magic? Traps?"
"Books are a form of magic."
The doctor lifted the volume he had just laid on the stack.
"Because they span time and distance more surely than any spell or charm. What did so-and-so think about such-and-such 200 years agone? Can you fly back through the ages and ask him? No, or at least probably not. But ah, if he wrote down his thoughts, if somewhere there exists a scroll or a book of his logical discourses, he speaks to you across centuries. And if you wish to visit far Nazgadu or lost Candia, you have also but to open a book."
"Yes, yes, I suppose I understand all that." Simon did not try to hide his disappointment. This was not what he had meant by the word magic. "What about traps, then? Why traps?" Morganis leaned forward, waggling the leather-bound volume under Simon's nose.
"A piece of writing is a trap," he said cheerily, "and the best kind. A book, you see, is the only kind of trap that keeps its captive, which is knowledge, alive forever. The more books you have,"
the doctor waved an all-encompassing hand about the room,
"the more traps, then the better chance of capturing some particular elusive, shining beast, one that might otherwise die unseen."
Morganis finished with a grand flourish, dropping the book back on the pile with a loud thump. A tiny cloud of dust leaped up, the flecks milling in the banded sunlight, leaking past the window bars. Simon stared at the shimmering dust for a moment, collecting his thoughts. Following the doctor's words was like trying to catch mice while wearing mittens. "But what about real magic?" he said at last, a stubborn crease between his brows. "Magic like they say Priorates does, up in the tower." For a brief instant, a look of anger, or was it fear, contorted the doctor's face.
"No, Simon," he said quietly. "Do not throw Priorates up to me. He is a dangerous, foolish man."
Despite his own horrid memories of the Red Priest, Simon found the intensity of the doctor's look strange and a little frightening. He nerved himself to ask another question.
You do magic, don't you? Why is Priorates dangerous?
Morgaine stood suddenly, and for a wild moment Simon feared that the old man might strike him or shout. Instead, Morgaine walked stiffly to the window and stared out for a moment. From where Simon sat, the doctor's thin hair was a bristly halo above his narrow shoulders. Morgaine turned and walked back. His face was grave, troubled by doubt.
Simon, he said, it will probably do me no good at all to say this, but I want you to keep away from Priorates. Don't go near him. And don't talk about him. Except to me, of course.
But why?
Contrary to what the doctor might think, Simon had already decided to stay far away from the alchemist. Morgaine's was not usually so forthcoming, though. And Simon was not going to waste the opportunity.
What is so bad about him?
Have you noticed that people are afraid of Priorates? That when he comes down from his new chambers in Hjeldin's tower, people hurry to get out of his way? There is a reason. He is feared because he himself has none of the right kinds of fear. It shows in his eyes.
Simon put the pen nib to his mouth and chewed thoughtfully, then took it out again.
Right kinds of fear? What does that mean?
There is no such thing as fearless, Simon, not unless a man is mad. People who are called fearless are usually just good at hiding it, and that is quite a different thing. Old King John knew fear, and both his sons certainly have known it. I have too. Priorates. Well, people see that he doesn't fear or respect the things that the rest of us do. That is often what we mean when we call someone mad.
Simon found this fascinating. He wasn't sure that he could believe either Prester John or Elias had ever been afraid, but the subject of Priorates was itself compelling.
Is he mad, Doctor? How could that be? He is a priest and one of the king's counselors.
But Simon remembered the eyes and toothy smile, and knew Morgaine's was right.
Let me put it another way.
Morgaine's twined a curl of snowy beard around his finger.
I spoke to you of traps, of searching for knowledge as though hunting an elusive creature. Well, where I and other knowledge seekers go out to our traps to see what bright beast we may have been lucky enough to capture, Priorates throws open his door at night and waits to see what comes in.
Morgaine's took the quill pen away from Simon, then lifted the sleeve of his robe and dabbed away some of the ink that had smeared on Simon's cheek.
The problem with Priorates' approach, he continued, is that if you do not like the beast that comes to call, it is hard, very, very hard, to get the door closed again.
Ha! Iskrimnor growled. A touch, man, a touch. Admit it.
The barest whisper across my vest, Joshua said, raising an eyebrow in feigned surprise. I'm sorry to see that infirmity has driven you to such desperate devices.
In mid-sentence, without altering tone, he lunged forward. Eskrimnor caught the wooden blade on his own hilt with a clack and skewed the thrust aside.
Infirmity? The old man hissed through bared teeth. I'll give you an infirmity that will send you crying back to your wet nurse.
Still swift for all his years and bulk, the Duke of Elritzhala pressed forward, his two-handed grip enabling him to keep good control as he swung the wooden sword in wide arcs. Joshua leapt backward, parrying, thin hair hanging in sweat-dampened points across his forehead. At last he saw an opening. As Iskrimnor brought the practiced sword around in another whistling sweep, the prince ducked down, using his own blade to help angle the duke's cut past his head, then hooked a foot behind Iskrimnor's heel and pulled. The duke crashed backward onto the ground like an old tree. A moment later, Joshua, too, had slumped to the grass at Escrimnor's side. With his single hand, he nimbly unlaced his thick padded vest and rolled onto his back. Escrimnor, puffing like a bellows, said nothing for several long moments. His eyes were closed. Sweat beads in his beard gleamed in the strong sunlight. Joshua leaned over to stare, then a look of worry crossing his face. He reached over to undo Iskrimnor's vest. As he got his fingers under the knot, the Duke's great pink hand came up and buffeted him on the side of the head, rolling him again onto his back. The prince lifted a hand to his ear and winced.
"Ha!" Iskrimnor wheezed. "That'll learn you, young pup."
Another stretch of silence followed as the two men lay gasping, staring up into the cloudless sky.
"You cheat, little man," Escrimnor said at last, levering himself into a sitting position. "The next time you wander back here to the Hayholt, I will have some revenge. Besides, had it not been so God's cursed hot and me so damnably fat, I would have staved in your ribs an hour ago."
Joshua sat up, shading his eyes. Two figures were approaching across the yellow grass of the tawny field. One was draped in a long robe.
"It is hot," Joshua said. "And in Novand," Iskrimnor grunted, pulling off the dueling vest. "The days of the hound are long behind us, and still this by-the-mother heat. Where is the rain? Frightened away, perhaps?"
He squinted at the two figures as they drew nearer.
"Oh, my young brother," one of the two figures called. "And old Nunculus Grimnor, it looks like you have worn yourselves out at your play. Joshua and the heat have damn near killed me, your majesty,"
Iskrimnor called out as the king approached. Elias was garbed in a rich tunic of sea green. Dark-eyed Priorates walked at his side, in flapping red robe, a comradely scarlet bat. Joshua stood, extending his hand to Iskrimnor as the older man clambered to his feet.
"Duke Iskrimnor, as usual, exaggerates," the prince said softly. "I was forced to knock him to the ground and sit on him to save my own life."
"Yes, yes, we were watching your horse playing from Hjeldin's tower," Elias said,
waving a careless hand back to where the tower's bulk loomed over the Hayholt's outwall.
"Weren't we, Priorates?"
"Yes, sire."
Priorates' smile was thin as thread, his voice a dry rasp.
"Your brother and the Duke are mighty men indeed." "By the way, your majesty," Escrimnor said, "may I ask you about something? I hate to trouble you with state business at such a time."
Elias, who had been staring out across the field, turned to the old Duke with a look of mild annoyance.
"I am, as it happens, discussing some important matters with Priorates. Why do you not come to see me when I am holding court on such things?"
He turned back again. Across the tawny field, Guthwulf and Count Eolair of Nad Mullach, a kinsman of Hernesteir's King Luth, were chasing a fractious stallion that had broken its traces. Elias laughed at the sight and elbowed Priorates, who favored him with another perfunctory smile.
"Your pardon, Majesty," Iskrimnor resumed, "but I have been trying to take this matter up with you for a fortnight. Your Chancellor, Helfkener, keeps telling me that you're too busy."
"At Hjeldin's tower,"
Joshua added curtly. For a moment the brothers locked eyes. Then Elias turned to the Duke.
"Oh, very well, then what is it?" "It's the royal garrison at Vestvenby. They have been gone for well over a month now, and remain unreplaced. The Frost March is still a wild place, and I do not have enough men to keep the northern Wealdhelm Road open without the Vestvenby garrison. Will you not send another troop?"
Elias had returned his gaze to Guthwulf and Eolair, two small figures shimmering in the heat as they chased the diminishing stallion. He answered without turning.
"Skali of Cold Skrykus says that you have more than enough men, old uncle.
He says you are hoarding your soldiers at Elvritzhala and Narved. Why is that?
His voice was deceptively light.
Before the startled Isgrimnor could reply, Joshua spoke up. Scarly Sharpnose is a liar if he says that. You are a fool if you believe him.
Elias whirled, his lip curling.
Is that right, Brother Joshua? Scarly is a liar. And I should take your word for that, you who have never tried to hide your hatred of me.
Now then, Isgrimnor interrupted, flustered and more than a little frightened. Elias, your majesty, you know my loyalty. I was the firmest friend your father ever had.
Oh yes, my father, Elias snorted.
And please do not take your displeasure over these scandalous rumors, for that is all they are, out on Joshua. He does not hate you. He is as loyal as I am.
Of that, said the king, I have no doubt. I shall garrison West Venby when I am ready to, and not before.
For a moment, Elias stared at them both, eyes wide. Priorates, long silent, reached up a white hand to tug at Elias' tunic sleeve.
Please, my lord, he said, this is not the time or place for such things.
He flicked an impudent, heavy-lidded glance at Joshua.
Or so I humbly submit.
The king stared at his minion, and then nodded once.
You are right. I have allowed myself to become angered over nothing.
Forgive me, uncle, he said to Isgrimnor, for as you said, it is a hot day. Forgive my temper.
He smiled.
Isgrimnor bobbed his head. Of course, sire. It is easy to let ill humors get the best of us in such stifling weather. It is strange this late in the year, is it not?
That it is.
Elias turned and grinned broadly at the red-cloaked priest.
Priorates here, for all his holy standing in the church, cannot seem to convince God to give us the rain we are praying for. Can you, counselor?
Priorates looked at the king strangely, ducking his head back into the collar of his robe, like an albino tortoise.
Please, my lord, he said, let us resume our talk and lead these gentlemen to their sword play.
Yes, the king nodded. I suppose so.
As the pair began to move off, Elias stopped. He wheeled slowly around to face Joshua, who was picking the wooden practice swords up from the dry grass.
You know, brother, the king said, it has been a long time since the two of us crossed staves. Watching you has put me in mind of those old times. What do you say we make a few passes, as long as we are all here upon the field?
A quiet moment passed.
As you wish, Elias, Joshua replied at last, and tossed one of the wooden blades to the king, who caught the hilt deftly in his right hand.
As a matter of fact, Elias said, a half-smile playing across his lips, I don't believe we have engaged since your accident.
He put on a look of greater solemnity.
Lucky for you, it was not your sword-wielding hand that was lost.
Lucky indeed.
Joshua measured himself a pace and a half, then turned to face Elias.
On the other hand, Elias began. Ah, that was a poor choice of words, wasn't it? My apologies. Alternately, it is unlucky that we must fence with these poor wooden oars.
He waggled the practice sword.
I do so enjoy watching you use, what do you call that thin blade of yours? Ah, Nadel. It is a pity you do not have it here.
Without warning, Elias leaped forward, swinging a hard backhand toward Joshua's head. The prince caught the blow, allowing it to slide by, then thrust forward. Elias trapped the oncoming lunge and deftly turned it aside. The two brothers backed apart, circling.
Yes,
Joshua leveled his sword before him, his thin face slick with sweat.
It is too bad that Nadel is not with me. It is also too bad that you do not have Brightnail.
The prince made a swift, downward cut and slid into another looping thrust. The king backpedaled swiftly, then counterattacked.
Brightnail, said Elias, breathing a little heavily. What do you mean by that?
You know that it is buried with our father.
He ducked an arching backhand and pushed Joshua back.
Oh, I know, said Joshua, parrying. But a king's sword, just like his kingdom, should be wisely
a thrust.
And proudly
a counter-thrust.
Should be wisely and carefully used by his heir.
The two wooden blades slid together with a noise like an axe cleaving timber. The pressure moved down until the hilts locked together, and Elias and Joshua's faces were merely inches apart. Muscles bunched beneath the brothers' shirts. For a moment they were nearly still, the only movement a slight trembling as they strained against each other. Finally, Joshua, who could not grip his hilt with two hands as the king could, felt his blade begin to slide. With a supple shrug, he disengaged and sprang backward, lowering the blade before him again. As they faced each other across the expanse of grass, chests heaving, a loud, deep tolling rang out across the tawny field. The bells of Green Angel Tower marking the noontide.
There you are, gentlemen, cried Escrimnor,
a sickly smile on his face. There had been no mistaking the naked hatred that flowed between the two.
There are the bells, and that means dinner time. Shall we call it a draw? If I don't get out of the sun and find a flagon of wine, I'm afraid I won't make it to Aiden Mansa this year. These old northern bones weren't meant to stand such cruel heat.
The Duke is right, my lord, Priorates rasped, laying his hand on Elias' wrist, which still held the upraised sword.
A reptilian smile tightened the priest's lips.
You and I can finish our business as we walk back.
Very well,
Elias grunted and tossed the sword over his shoulder, where it struck the ground and cartwheeled once, then fell flat.
Thank you for the exercise, brother.
He turned and offered his arm to Priorates. They moved away, scarlet and green.
What do you say, Joshua?
Escrimnor asked, taking the wooden sword from the prince's hand.
Shall we go and have some wine?
Yes, I suppose so,
Joshua replied, bending to pick up the vests as Escrimnor retrieved the sword the king had flung away. He straightened, staring into the distance.
Do the dead always stand between the living, uncle?
He asked quietly, then drew his hand across his face.
Never mind you. Let us go and find some place cool.
Really, Judith, it's all right. Rachel won't mind.
Simon's questing hand was captured mere inches away from the mixing bowl. Judith's grip, for all her pinkness and plumpness, was quite strong.
Get on with you. Rachel wouldn't mind, indeed. Rachel would break every bone in this frail old body of mine.
Pushing Simon's hand back into his lap, Judith blew a strand of hair out of her eyes and wiped her fingers on her stained apron.
I should have known that the merest whiff of the Aidentide bread a bacon would bring you round like an Inniscritch camp dog.
Simon traced sad patterns in the flower-strewn counter.
But Judith, you've got mounds and mounds of dough. Why can't I have a taste from the bowl?
Judith levered herself up from the stool and moved gracefully to one of the kitchen's hundreds of shelves, like a barge on a placid river. Two young scullions scattered before her like startled seagulls.
Now where, she mused, where is that crock of sweet butter?
As she stood, finger to mouth in a thoughtful pose, Simon edged nearer to the mixer bowl.
Don't you dare, laddie!
Judith cast the words over her shoulder without even turning to look at him. Did she have eyes on all sides?
It's not that there's not dough to spare, Simon. Rachel doesn't want you spoiling your supper.
She continued her perusal of the orderly shelves, stacked with goods, as Simon sat back and glowered. Despite the occasional frustrations, the kitchen was a fine place. Longer even than Morgaini's chambers, it seemed nevertheless small and intimate, full of the pulsing warmth of the ovens and the sense of good things. Lamb stew seethed in iron pots, Aidentide breads were rising in the oven, and papery brown onions hung like copper bells in the fogged window. The air was thick with the smells of spices, tangy ginger and cinnamon, saffron, cloves, and scratchy pepper. Scullions rolled barrels of flour and pickled fish through the door, or pulled loaves from the baking ovens with flat wooden paddles. One of the chief apprentices was boiling rice paste over the fire, in a pot of almond milk, making a blanch sweet for the king's dessert. And Judith herself, a huge gentlewoman who made the giant kitchen seem as intimate as a farmer's cot, directed all without once raising her voice. A kindly but sharp-eyed sovereign in her kingdom of bricks and pots and firelight. She returned with the missing crock, and as Simon regretfully watched, she took a long-handled brush and dabbed the butter over the braided Aidentide loaves. "Judith," Simon asked at last, "if it's almost Aidenmancer, why is there no snow? Morgane said he's never seen it wait this late in the year."
"That I don't know, I'm sure," Judith said briskly. "We had no rain in November either. I expect it's just a dry year."
She frowned and brushed again at the nearest loaf. "They have been watering the sheep and cows from the town in the Hayholtz moat," Simon said.
"Have they then?"
"Yes. You can see the brown rings around the edges where the water's gone down. There are places you can stand where the water doesn't even reach your knees."
"And you found them all, I don't doubt."
"I think so," Simon replied proudly. "And last year, this time, it was all frozen.
Think of it."
Judith looked up from her loaf glazing to fix Simon with her pale, kind blue eyes.
"I know it's exciting when things like this happen," she said. "But just remember, laddie, we need that water. There'll be no more fine meals if we get neither rain nor snow. You can't drink the Kinsler, you know."
The Kinsler, like the Glenywent that fed it, was as salty as the sea.
"I know that," Simon said. "I'm sure it will snow soon, or rain, since it's so warm. It's just that it will be a very strange midwinter."
Judith was about to say something else when she stopped, looking over Simon's shoulder at the doorway.
"Yes, girl? What is it?"
she asked. Simon turned to see a familiar curly-haired serving girl standing a few feet away, Hepzibah.
"Rachel sent me to find Simon, Mum," she replied, giving a lazy half-curtsy. "She needs him to get something down from a high shelf."
"Well, dearie, you don't need to ask me. He's just sitting here mooning over my bacon, not being any help or anything."
She made a shooing gesture at Simon. He did not see it as he was admiring Hepzibah's tight, cinched apron and the wavy hair which her cap could neither control nor contain.
"Lysias, mercy boy, get on with you!"
Judith leaned over and poked him with the handle of the brush. Hepzibah had already turned and was nearly out the door. As Simon scrambled down off his stool to follow, the kitchen mistress laid a warm hand on his arm.
"Here," she said.
"I seem to have spoiled this one. See, it's all crooked."
She handed him a loaf of warm bread, twisted like a piece of rope and smelling of sugar.
"Thank you,"
he said, tearing off a piece and pushing it into his mouth as he hurried to the door.
"It's good."
"Of course it is,"
Judith called after him.
"If you tell Rachel, I'll skin you."
By the time she had finished, she was shouting at an empty doorway. It only took a few paces before Simon caught up with Hepzibah, who was not walking very quickly.
"Was she waiting for me?"
he wondered, feeling oddly breathless, then decided it was more likely that anyone given an errand, which took them out of Rachel's clutches, would dawdle all they could.
Would you like some of this?"
he asked, gasping slightly. The serving girl took a piece of the sweet bread and sniffed it, then popped it into her mouth.
"Oh, that's good, that is," she said,
then gifted Simon with a dazzling smile, eyes crinkling at the corners.
"Give me another, won't you?"
He did. They passed out of the hall and into the courtyard. Hepzibah crossed her arms as if to hug herself.
"Oh, it's cold," she said.
It was actually fairly warm, blazing hot considering it was Dekanda month. But now that Hepzibah had mentioned it, Simon was sure that he could detect a breeze,
Yes, it is cold, isn't it? He said, and fell silent again. As they walked past the corner of the inner keep that housed the royal residences, Hepzibah pointed up to a small window just below the upper turret.
See there? She asked. Just the other day, I saw the princess standing there, combing her hair. Oh my, but hasn't she got nice hair?
A dim memory of gold catching the afternoon sunlight floated up in Simon's mind, but he was not to be distracted.
Oh, I think you have much nicer hair, he said, then turned away to look at one of the guard towers in the middle bailey wall, a treacherous blush stealing up his cheeks. Do you really? Laughed Hepzibah. I think it's the worst tangle. Princess Miriamelle has ladies to brush hers. Sarah, you know her, the fair-haired girl, knows one of them. Sarah says that this lady told her the princess is very sad sometimes, and that she wants to go back to Merrimond where she grew up.
Simon was looking with great interest at Hepzibah's neck, wreathed by the sprays of curly brown hair that hung down from her cap.
He said. You want to know something else?
Hepzibah asked, turning away from the tower.
What are you staring at?
She squealed, but her eyes were merry.
Stop it! I told you my hair was in a strew. Do you want to know something else about the princess?
What?
Her father wants her to marry Earl Fengbald, but she doesn't want to. The king is very angry with her, and Fengbald is threatening to leave the court and go back to Falshire. Although why he'd want to do that, who knows? Lofsunu says he never will, since no one in his earldom has enough money to appreciate his horses and clothes and things.
Who's Lofsunu? Simon wanted to know.
Oh,
Hepzibah looked coy.
He's a soldier, I know. He's with Count Breugar's household force. He's very handsome.
The last of the Aidentide bread turned to wet ashes in Simon's mouth.
A soldier? He said quietly. Is he a relative of yours?
Hepzibah giggled, a sound that Simon was beginning to find a little irritating.
A relative? Merciful Rehab? No, I should say not. Mooning around after me all the time?
She giggled again. Simon liked it even less.
Maybe you've seen him, she continued. He's a guard in the Eastern Barracks. Big shoulders and a beard.
She sketched in the air a man in whose shadow two Simons could comfortably have sat on a summer day. Simon's feelings were at war with his more sensible nature. His feelings won.
Soldiers are stupid, he grunted. They are not, said Hepzibah. You take that back. Lofsunu is a fine man. Some day he's going to marry me.
Well, you'll make a fine couple, Simon snarled, then felt sorry. I hope you'll be happy, he finished, hoping that the reasons for his resentment were not as crystallinely clear as he felt sure they were.
Well, we will be, said Hepzibah, mollified.
She stared at a pair of yeoman warders walking on the battlements above their heads, long pikes couched on shoulders.
Some day, Lofsunu will be a sergeant, and we shall have a house of our own in Urchester. We'll be happy as can be. Happier than that poor princess, anyway.
Grimacing, Simon picked up a round stone and rattled it off the bailey wall. Dr. Morgainis, pacing the battlements, looked down as Simon and one of the young serving girls passed beneath him. A dry breeze blew his hood back from his head as the couple passed below. He smiled and silently wished Simon good luck. The boy appeared to need it. His awkward carriage and bouts of sullenness made him seem more child than man, but he had the height and showed the promise of growing into it someday. Simon was straddling the borderline, and even the doctor, whose age no one in the castle now could guess,
remembered what that was like. There was a sudden whirring of wings in the air behind him. Morghenis turned, but slowly, as if it was no surprise. Anyone watching would have seen a fluttering grey shadow that hung in the air before him, for the span of a few heartbeats, then disappeared into the spacious folds of his grey sleeves. The doctor's hands, which had been empty a moment earlier, now held a small roll of fine parchment bound with a slender blue ribbon. Cupping it in one palm, he unrolled it with a gentle finger. The message upon it was in the southern tongue of Naban and the church, but the letters were stark Rimmersgaard runes.
Morgan, the fires of Stormspike have been lit. From Tangoldir I have seen their smokes 9 days, and their flames 8 nights. The white foxes are awake again, and in the darkness they trouble the children. I have also sent winged words to our smallest friend, but I doubt they will find him unawares. Someone has been knocking at dangerous doors. Jan Auger.
Beside the signature, the author had drawn a crude feather in a circle.
Hard weather, is it not?
A dry voice said.
And yet so pleasant for walking on the battlements.
The doctor whirled, crumpling the parchment in his hand. Priorati stood at his shoulder, smiling.
The air is full of birds today, the priest said. Are you a student of birds, doctor? Do you know much of their habits?
I have some small knowledge of them,
Morghenis said quietly. His blue eyes were narrowed.
I myself have thought of studying them, Priorates nodded. They are easily captured, you know, and they hold so many secrets that the inquiring mind would find valuable.
He sighed and rubbed his smooth chin.
Ah, well, merely another thing to consider. My time is so full already. Good day, Doctor. Enjoy the air.
He moved off down the battlement, boots clicking on the stone. For a long while after the priest had gone, Morghenis stood quietly, staring at the blue-gray northern sky. Chapter 8. Bitter Air and Sweet. It was late in the month of Jonivere. The rains had still not come, as the sun began to sink behind the western walls, and insects gossiped in the tall, dry grass. Simon and Jeremias, the chandler's boy, sat back to back and panting.
Come on, then, Simon forced himself to his feet. Let's have another go.
Jeremias, now unsupported, slumped backward until he lay outstretched in the scratchy grass, like an upended tortoise.
You go on, he wheezed. I'll never be a soldier.
Of course you will, said Simon, annoyed at such talk. We both will.
You were much better last time. Come on, get up!
With a groan of pain, Jeremias allowed himself to be tugged upright. He reluctantly took the barrel stave Simon handed to him.
Let's go in, Simon. I hurt all over.
You think too much,
Simon responded, and lifted his own stave.
Have at you!
Stave smacked on stave.
Ouch!
Simon yelped.
Ho, ho!
Chortled Jeremias, much heartened.
A mortal blow!
The clicking and smacking resumed. It had not been just his unsuccessful flirtation with Hepzibah that reawakened Simon's old fascination with the glories of the military life. Before Elias had come to the throne, Simon had felt sure that his true desire, the one for which he would give anything, was to be Morghenis' apprentice and to learn all the secrets of the doctor's muddled, magical world. But now that he had it, and had replaced plodding Inch as the doctor's helper, the glory had begun to pale. There was so much work, for one thing, and Morghenis was so damnably rigorous about everything. And had Simon learned to do any magic at all? He had not. Placed against hours of reading and writing and sweeping and polishing in the doctor's dark chamber, great deeds on the battlefield and the admiring glances of young women, were not to be sneered at. Deep in Jacob the Chandler's tallow-scented den, Fat Jeremias had also been caught up in the martial splendor of the king's first year. During the week-long pageants that Elias seemed to hold virtually every month, all the color of the realm settled on the jousting lists, the knights like shiny butterflies of silk and gleaming steel, far more beautiful than any mortal thing. The glory-spiced wind that blew across the tournament field awakened deep longings in the breasts of young men. Simon and Jeremias went to the cooper for long slats to fashion into swords, just as they had in childhood. They traded blows together for hours after chores were finished, at first staging their mock battles in the stables until Shem Horsegroom threw them out for the peace of his wards, then moving to the unmowed grass just south of the tawny field. Night after night, Simon came limping back to the servants' quarters, breeches snagged and shirt torn, and Rachel the Dragon turned up her eyes and prayed aloud for St. Reup to save her from the blockheadedness of boys, then rolled up her sleeves and added some bruises to those Simon had already garnered.
"I think," Simon puffed, "that's enough."
Jeremias, pink-faced and doubled over, could only nod his agreement. As they trooped back toward the castle in the fading light, sweating and huffing like plough oxen, Simon noted with approval that Jeremias was beginning to lose some of his lumpishness. Another month or so and he would begin to resemble a soldier. Before their regular dueling began, he had looked more like something his master might put a wick into.
"That was good today, wasn't it?" Simon asked.
Jeremias rubbed his head through his cropped hair and gave Simon a look of disgust.
"I don't know how you talked me into this," he grumbled. "They will never let folk like us be anything but cookfire boys."
"But on the field of battle, anything can happen," Simon said.
"You might save the king's life from Thrything's men or Naraxi raiders and be knighted on the spot."
Jeremias was not impressed.
"And how are we going to get them to take us in the first place, with no families, nor horses, nor swords even?"
He waggled his stave.
"Yes," said Simon. Well then, I'll think of something."
Agreed Jeremias, and mopped his flushed face with the hem of his tunic. The flare of torchlight sprang up before them in a score of places as they neared the castle walls. What had been open grassy space in the shadow of the hayholt's outwall was now an infestation of wretched huts and tents, piled together and overlapping each other like the scales of an old sick lizard. The grass was long gone, cropped to the soil by sheep and goats. As the ragged shanty dwellers milled about, setting up their campfires for the night and calling their children in ahead of the darkness, the dust kicked into gritty plumes that swirled briefly before settling, dyeing clothes and tent fabric alike a dusky grey-brown.
"If it doesn't rain soon," said Jeremias, frowning at a pack of shrieking children who tugged at the faded garments of a faded-looking woman, "the Erkin Guard will have to drive them away. We don't have enough water to keep giving it to them. Let them go and dig their own wells."
"But where?" Simon started to ask, then broke off, staring. Down at the end of one of the squatter town byways, he saw what seemed a familiar face. It had appeared for only a moment in a crowd, then disappeared. But he was sure it was that of the boy he had caught spying, the one who had left him to the wrath of the sexton Barnabas.
"It's that one I told you about," he hissed excitedly.
Jeremias looked back without comprehension.
"You know, Malachias. I owe him something."
Simon reached the knot of people where he felt sure he had seen the spy's sharp-featured face. They were mostly women and young children, but a few older men stood among them, bent and withered like old trees. They had surrounded a young woman crouching on the ground before the opening to a half-tumbled hovel, which backed directly onto the stone of the great outwall. She held the pale body of a tiny child in her lap, as she rocked herself from side to side, weeping. Malachias was nowhere in sight.
Simon looked at the impassive, battered faces around him, and then down at the crying woman. "Is the child sick?" he asked someone next to him. "I'm Dr. Morgani's apprentice. Should I go and fetch him?" An old woman turned her face up to him. Her eyes, set in an intricate net of dirty wrinkles, were as harsh and dark as a bird's.
"Get away from us, castle man," she said, and spat into the dirt. "King's man, just get away."
"But I want to help," Simon began, when a strong hand gripped his elbow.
"Do what she says, lad."
It was a wiry old man with a matted beard. The look on his face was not unkind, as he tugged Simon away from the circle.
"You can do naught here, and people are bad angry. The child is dead. Go on with you."
He gave Simon a gentle but firm push. Jeremias was still standing in the same spot when Simon returned. The campfires all around outlined his worried expression in flickering light.
"Don't do that, Simon," he whined. "I don't like it out here, especially after the sun has gone down."
"They looked at me like they hated me," Simon murmured, puzzled and upset. But Jeremias was already hurrying ahead. None of the torches were lit, but strange, smoky light filled the long hall. He could see not a soul stirring anywhere in the hayholt, but down every passageway echoed the sound of voices lifted in song and laughter. Simon moved from one room to another, pulling aside curtains, opening pantry doors, but still could find no one. The voices seemed almost to mock him as he searched, now swelling in volume, now diminishing, chanting and singing in 100 different languages, not one of them his own.